You're listening to Rambling Business, the only multimedia podcast with Rick and Brandon,
where we get into your business no matter where it is.
And today we'll be talking about cashing in on the 19th century blue silver mine. We leave our San Diego microbrewery series and fly you out northwest to the old west town of Virginia City, Nevada. Not Nevada City, Virginia. Or Virginia City, Virginia. But Virginia City, Nevada.
Or Nevada City, Nevada. Yeah, there is a Nevada
there
City.
There is a Nevada, Nevada City. We're leaving Jagged California Coast and flying to northwest in the middle of Nevada Chaparral that's hundreds of miles from the Pacific. One of the strange anomalies of California.
You could actually fly northwest and be farther away from
the
Pacific.
I know. It's because the coast is cattywampus.
That's why they call it strange out here. I don't know.
We start our Virginia City series taking you into a hole because it's known for its mining. It's a silver mine, and we talk to the owner, Greg Hess, and what he's done with it. Also coming your way are some business tips, a travel tip, and of course, our tax tale.
Greg comes from a line of miners. His dad, his grandfather, probably some uncles, you know, we're all
maybe
down there in the hole.
Maybe a tough aunt. Some children? Hopefully not.
He was also a mining contractor. So, he had mining in his blood, definitely. He purchased the Best and Belcher Mining Company that was established in 1859.
But he purchased it recently, not in 1859.
Yeah, I don't think he did.
Because we spoke to him.
That's right.
And he wasn't an old-timey ghost.
That's right. Do you think maybe he purchased in 1859 on layaway?
Oh, maybe.
Maybe that long maybe ago, 100 did, years, 120 years.
Maybe he did like a Back to the Future thing.
Oh.
And he purchased it and get, yeah.
There's all these things that happen now I don't even understand. Greg didn't buy a mine for the untouched mineral load that was in the area like most people would. Mm-hmm. You know, at one time, Virginia City was the richest place in the United States, which is a very odd thing to think considering how much industrial revolutionary things happened in this country.
Oh, yeah, and this is like a tiny, tiny town.
Yeah. At first, miners were digging for gold, and they kept running into this pesky, weird mineral that was tainted blue. They just like throw
blue
it to the
clay.
Side. That's right.
That's my favorite thing about that. The tour that we went on was he was like, people hated that blue clay because it was just as heavy as gold. It would settle in all the same places, and just get in their way. They'd have to dig it out. It's so heavy. But it turns out that this blue clay was a certain kind of silver, blue silver that you had to refine out of this clay to be able to. Didn't he say it was silver mercury?
I don't know, but mercury was what they mined there also. But I hope it wasn't mercury. And it's I guess that when you only get it, heat is when it becomes a problem, right?
It's when it's liquid. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, there was 40,000 people in three towns during the 1870s. The Golden Curry Mine hauled in $16 million. The Consolidated Silver Mine ultimately brought in $180 million, though that was late in the 20th century.
Yeah, so it's a long-producing mine.
They also said that a ton of dirt brought you $900 of silver. Now, I don't know what era they were talking about in this tour when he said that, but
what was $900 in 1857? It's way big from different in 1940. Yeah.
But by the end of the time, 300 mines had been dug out in that area, but only 15 made their owners wealthy.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's a hard, people say restaurants are hard businesses. That's a pretty big failure rate.
But look, that's 5%.
5%.
That's actually not a bad, you think about it, that's really not a bad, a 5% chance to become wealthy. I think people have less than that now.
I mean, people buy lottery tickets.
Well, that's another thing. We'll do a whole episode on lottery tickets or something.
But the thing is, a lot of people made it rich, but there was a huge cost. In addition to all these people going bankrupt, there was a lot of deaths because safety back then wasn't that great. There was this drill that our tour guide mentioned. It was called the Widowmaker.
His name is also Greg, by the way.
Different Greg.
Yeah, right.
There's a lot of things are known as Widowmakers, though. This was a drill that, people would be drilling to put in dynamite to blow some of the face off, the face of the mountain or the mine.
Face of the mountain.
Mount Rushmore. Yeah. They weren't drilling faces in them. But they drill in to put the dynamite in, but they'd hit this pocket of steam because it's, so far down that there would be, I don't know, volcanic
Well, the whole area is volcanic. You know, you have Mammoth Mountain is down the corner.
So one person would be drilling, and the drill would be resting. Drill bit would be resting on their shoulder, and the other person was pushing in the drill, and they'd both get a steam bath that wasn't of the spa variety, and they die.
Now, see, I remember when plumbing, when I was working as a teenager, and your grandpa's partner Dan, he'd have this big chisel. And he'd say, "Okay, get the sledgehammer. I'll hold the chisel. You swing it." And I said, "I don't want to swing it. I miss it. Crack your hand." Yep. He says, "Well, fine. Then we'll switch. You hold the chisel, and I'll swing the hammer." This drove me nuts.
Yeah.
You know, I forget which one I went for. I kind of like sat there and kind of figured out what my chances were.
Did some quick calculations on the back of an envelope. But this drill was called the Widowmaker.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things that are called Widowmakers, though. Yeah. Uh-huh. Coconuts in certain places because they'll fall off the trees and kill people.
Drinks, I'm sure.
A burger.
A burger.
A really spicy burger I saw once called the Widowmaker.
Anyway, so Greg, though, figured that opening the mine to the public was far more lucrative than mining, believe it or not, having it like a tourist attraction. And also what this did is it preserved the knowledge and history of mining in Virginia City. So this kind of move we call as disruptive to the industry. Disruptive, say that word right. Disruptive, and disrupting my speech here. Disruptive innovation creates a new marketplace by disrupting an existing market. So here the market was people who were trying to buy silver with using this asset of a silver mine. He disrupted this whole thing by focusing on a different kind of market.
And I thought that was interesting. What made his decision even more unique was when you think of mines, you think of, you know, driving up a dusty trail or hiking or taking a burro up there.
Uh-huh.
But this guy, Greg, has great location because location is everything. The entrance to this mine is in the back of the Ponderosa Saloon. So you go into the saloon and you go take this mine tour. You go back and they open up this kind of vault mine door.
Yeah.
And you go and head in.
Yeah.
And then we suggest having drinks in afterward. They had good drinks and food.
Yeah. But not before.
Not before. Because you have to pay attention to your head a lot when you're in this mine. They do provide helmets.
Yeah.
But still, you bumping noggins.
The average miner was 5'7". And
back then, yes.
And so I'm 6'2", and I had to wear a helmet because I had been on this mine tour before. And before I didn't have a helmet, and I whacked my head. Yeah. You know, I was ducking. But when it was
he said that they even had dug out the floor a little bit because people are so tall nowadays.
Yeah.
And still you had to crouch.
What this reminds me of is there was this movie called, I think it's called Paint Your Wagon with Lee Marvin, Robert Goulet. I can't remember some of the other people in there. I think Clint Eastwood maybe in there. And
probably.
This was a mining town just like this one.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys were drunks, like Lee Marvin, you know. And they were, they saw these miners coming in, and they go to pay at the bar. You know the bar we saw? And
that's
an authentic bar. And so they go to pay, and they would pay in gold dust. And what happens when they had to pay, sometimes, or almost all the time, these guys were drunk, the gold dust would fall out of their hands a little bit as they pay, okay?
Yeah.
And it would go down the floor. The floor had slats with little quarter-inch gaps. And they figured, if we tunneled underneath this thing, we could be rich.
Yeah.
And they did.
That's silly. You're listening to Rambling Business. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Rick E. Norris and Accountancy Corporation. If you'd like to get the full experience, check out our website for videos, music, pictures, takeaways, and travel tips. www.ramblingbusiness.com. Now it's time for our tax tales, where we tell you strange and unusual taxes from the past and the present.
Tax tales.
A woo.
Since we're talking about mining today, an interesting thing that we learned on this tour is that when you're mining a silver mine, miners were only allowed one candle.
Why was that?
Because they're expensive.
Oh,
they
okay.
didn't. It was the bosses were trying to cut down on costs. So they give you one candle. And this is like pitch black middle of the mountain mining. The thing is, the thought it was expensive then. It's good they didn't live in England in 1789. Candles were taxed there at a very high rate.
Taxed and waxed.
Taxed and waxed. people, it got so bad that people were making their own candles, and they had to pass a law that said people were forbidden from making their own candles unless they obtained a license and paid taxes on the candles they produced.
Mm.
They still do this with, like, liquor. You're not allowed to produce your own liquor because of taxes.
Yeah.
Alcohol, yeah, tobacco, yeah, firearms, yeah. And come after you. The tax was eventually appealed in 1831, and candles became less of a rich person thing.
Yeah.
Which is funny because now candles are incredibly expensive.
Yeah, right. I'm going back to make them.
Now it's time for our travel tips, where we tell you what things you can do while visiting Virginia City.
One thing that we did, we went to Virginia City, is we stopped by the Visitor Center. They were very helpful and had some really good inside knowledge about some very unique businesses that we were to go see and end up interviewing.
And they have a great idea of what's open and when, too, you know, because it varies depending on the week if someone's on vacation in a little town like this.
So we talked to some great people there, including Amy, who introduced us some businesses, and it was a great experience that we had. So we really highly recommend you stop by there first and then go around to all the great places that they have to offer.
Now it's time for our takeaways, where we tell you what specific steps you can take to implement what we are talking about on the podcast. And the first thing to think about is, we talked a little about being disruptors. It's good to be a disruptor in your industry. Companies successfully accomplish this by thinking strategically and creatively. Check out the book that created the term Disruptive Technologies, Catching the Wave by Clayton M. Christensen on more of how to think disruptively.
Right. The second thing is, do your homework. You know, just don't jump into a business and think that the passion is going to drive you through it. In Greg's case, his experience told him that there probably wasn't a lot of ore in the ground, and if there was, it'd take a lot of money to get it out of. So, see it out of the ground. So what he did is that he changed his direction and used an industry that could benefit his investment.
The third thing to think about is another thing to do for homework, and that's to focus on your customer. In this case, Greg saw the Virginia City area as a tourist attraction because people would come looking for this history about mining. And there's also that famous saloon right there where the dead man's hand, was it Wild Bill?
Oh, that no, that's in...
that's in Tombstone?
Yeah, no, that's in... it's in...
Bucket of... What bucket
in,
of blood?
In the black... Oh, you're talking about the Bucket of Blood.
I'm
that's a different
the
one.
Bucket of
the
blood.
One you're
different.
Talking about is in the Black Hills, the shirt I wear all the time.
There's a pretty famous saloon where a different pirate massacre happened. It happened all the time back then. Bucket of Blood.
Oh, okay.
So he looked at this and said, you know, people are doing saloons, people are doing all this sorts of stuff. Uh-huh. How can I educate people and fill a need that hasn't been fulfilled? And so that's why he decided to have this tour business.
Mm-hmm. Number four, determine if you're a seasonal business. Now, if you sell Christmas trees, you know, you're probably not going to be selling them in July.
Oh, who knows? You might be on that pumpkin patch. Maybe are those the same people?
Yeah, they're usually the same people. Oh. Yeah. In Virginia City, the holidays are a big draw. We were there between Christmas and New Year's when we did this, and that was very big. But they said after January 1st, things fall off. So, and they die down until about summer, I guess, because it's, you know, it's cold and people really...
People go up there to ski because it's right near Tahoe.
Yeah. So you should reduce or eliminate your variable costs when the high season is not around. So what variable costs mean is that it's a cost that goes up for every dollar that comes in revenue. A fixed cost is something that is always happening. So like your utilities most likely will be a fixed cost unless you're running like a manufacturing plant, then it becomes more like a combination of both.
Or if you're running a seasonal hotel, if you know you're turning off the lights and people aren't using the water and heating most of the rooms, that utilities could be seasonal.
Well, more like a variable cost in a hotel would be like soap, because more people using soap. And also like your labor.
Yeah, so when you have the hippie commune con at your hotel, your soap price costs are probably going to go down. Now it's time to answer a question from one of our viewers. This one comes from John over email. I'm retired and I have a reverse mortgage for years on my property. I'm thinking of refinancing my loan on a conventional mortgage. I hear there are tax benefits when you pay off a reverse mortgage. Is that true?
John, as we always say, make sure you check with your tax advisor for an answer that pertains to your specific situation.
Because everything's different.
Yeah, states are different, but even people's situations are different. Mm-hmm. How much you itemize, what do you itemize, things like that. But what the tax preparer should do is a tax projection to let you know what the costs that you can write off. For example, interest expenses may be one big advantage. With a reverse mortgage, you've been accumulating all this interest that you're not paying, mm-hmm. but now that you're paying off the mortgage, you may be able to get those deductions. But there are complicated rules regarding interest paid on a mortgage. So don't jump into it. We always say about doing your homework. Hire somebody else to do the homework.
You don't want to put your biggest asset in hock without doing a lot of research, right?
Right. So make sure that you make an informed decision and get all the facts to your tax preparer.
That's all we have this week. Tune in next week when we'll continue in Virginia City businesses by talking to a real Virginia City hat maker. Cowboy hats.
Yes, lots of different kind of hats.
And lots of different kind of hats, but I always think of cowboy hats.
But he uses 19th century techniques in the 21st century.
Hopefully not mercury.
Nope.
Well, thank you for listening this week. I'm Brandon.
This is Rick. And thank you for letting us get into your business, no matter where it is.
Our music and podcast was produced by my brother, Devin S. Norris. For all your music composition and podcast needs, check out www.devinsnorris.com.